Yes.
Shas Harav. Welcome and good morning, everyone, to this morning's Kolo Yom Shishi. Please make sure to either shut off your cell phones or keep them on vibrate. Please hold the questions to the end of this year. We will have a short 5-minute break for coffee or questions at the end of shiur number one. We would like to thank the Borvik family for sponsoring this morning's shiurim. Gedalia informed me a couple of days ago that he and Rabbi Tanchum Cohen are first cousins. And the shiur is in honor of their grandfather's 20th yahrzeit, Mr. Samuel Z. Cohen, Nesanel Zalman ben Yaakov al Cohen, his neshama shev in Aliyah. Rabbi Cohen graduated YU, where he received smicha and subsequently enjoyed a 4-year fellowship in the Wexner Kollel Elyon. He has co-edited 3 REITs journals and contributed 9 articles to those and other REITs annuals. During his years at REITs, Rabbi Cohen served as a scholar in residence in communities across the USA, including Boca Raton, Detroit, and Los Angeles, and pioneered numerous learning programs for both adults and teens. More recently, he is the founding Rebbe of the base Midrash Katan, which affords aspiring B'nai Torah at MTA the opportunity to learn intensely and extensively as members of the YU base Midrash. Rabbi Cohen is also privileged to assist Rabbi Yaakov Neuberger at Congregation Beth Abraham in Bergenfield, New Jersey. Rabbi Cohen.
Thank you for those very, very generous words. The beginning and end were true. It is a special pleasure to be here. Beth Abraham feels almost like a sister shul, and it's a pleasure to be here. And it is. I am grateful to the Borviks and the Offenbachers and the Rosenbluths for sponsoring the shiur and coming to the shiur and together making it Le'ilui Nishmas, our grandfather, the son of Zalman ben Yaakov Dov, HaKohen. I'm a couple years younger, so my perspective on Poppy is a little bit as a child's perspective. Yanina's already smiling. He always struck me as someone who could engage my older brothers in a discussion of legal theory after hearing a shiur from his Rav about the Masecha Sanhedrin, and thinking about how that interacted with his professional expertise as an attorney, and at the same time made extraordinary patience for little children and our interests. And I still have memories of him. He was able to wait, like no one else I ever saw, to wait patiently. I wanted to go after, he picked me up after day camp, and I wanted to stay for some performance. And he said, sure. He gave me a couple of dollars to pay for it, and I still remember distinctly, I must have been 6 or 7 years old. So I said, so you'll come back later? He said, no, I'll wait for you. And he had the rare ability to just patiently wait for other people. And it's certainly a midah that at this point in time in particular, this tkufa from the year, we would do well to adopt. Bershus Mar Gassra, Bershus Rabbi Sablovsky, I'm zochet to have as a neighbor both in Bergenfield and in Beit Meir. And with the gratitude to the committee, and particularly Brian Thau, who made sure to dial the I's and cross all the T's to invite us and to bring us here to Beit Shemesh. I want to open a strange story. It sets us up for the work of the next couple of days. I'm going to tell us a story, Maseches Bava Kamma. A story of an Amora. The story took place probably 1700 years ago. In the streets of Nahar Da'ah. Nahar Da'ah at this point in time was one of the location where the major yeshivos in the period of the Amoraim, the time of the Gemara. And it was at this point in time home to a semi-autonomous Jewish community headed by the Reish Galusa, who had some authority from the Persian Empire, sovereign authority over the Jewish community, to enforce law, including apparently Halacha and halachic mores. And this Amora we don't know so much about. His name is Eliezer Zeira, clearly great Talmud Chacham. He's walking down the streets of Nahar Da'a, and he was arrested. Arrested by the Jewish police. His crime was wearing black shoes. Makes sense. Well, how does that hang together? I think a couple of us looking around. Some of us have not yet put on our sandals, and we might have been, myself included, we could have been apprehended for the same crime. So what does this all mean? So you take a look at the Gemara. The Gemara says that Eliezer Zeir is hauled in by the Jewish police. His crime is the crime of arrogance. He's arrested for the gaiva. They say to him, "Who do you think you are? You're wearing black shoes," which at the time was unusual, was abnormal, and was seen as he was engaging in this black shoe wearing as an expression of avelus, of mourning over Churban Yerushalayim. It's a pleasure. I see it's a kavod to have Rabbi Handel in the crowd. I'm touched. I'm honored. It brings back many, many, many fond memories and a lot of early inspiration for work in Chinuch. Thank you for coming. So he's apprehended. I say to him, "Who do you think you are? You have the audacity to think that you are worthy of being Mis'abel of Yerushalayim. That you can walk publicly in black shoes as a sign of avails." So Gemara, it's a strange arraignment. And he tries to explain to them that he's actually unusual Talmud Chacham, and he's a great Talmud Chacham, and then they're not sure about it, and they give him a bechina. The Gemara goes through this whole story, and they ask him some halachic questions, and they realize that he really is a worthy Torah scholar, and he's worthy to be Mis'abel of Yerushalayim, and he's released. You look at this story, and you're left scratching a lot of things about this story, very puzzling. One in particular is that, why isn't that all of us, regardless of what we're wearing, whether we're wearing sandals or black shoes, but aren't we all guilty of this crime, if it were to be a crime? He was arrested for having the audacity of being so arrogant as to think that he could be Mis'abel over Yerushalayim. Aren't we all busy with that right now? Aren't we nearing the climax of 3 weeks, of 9 days? Tisha B'Av is looming large. If nothing dramatic changes in the next couple of hours, we're going to all be Mis'abel over Yerushalayim. We're all going to take off our shoes and sit on the floor And it seems this Gemara makes it sound as though that's the province of great tzaddikim only, and for anyone short of an unusual tzaddik to arrogate to himself that right, it's meaningless. What does this all mean? So there's a comment of the Kuzari early in the Sefer that may shed a little bit of light on the story and give us sort of direction. The work of the next couple of hours, the next couple of days. Kuzari makes the point famously in talking about Eretz Yisrael. He says, you know, across the world, there we all know that geographically, different parts of the world have different physical climates. Different parts of the world different lend themselves to different flora and fauna. And you don't see polar bears walking around Beit Shemesh, and you don't see palm trees growing in Bergenfield. And different parts of the world lend themselves. But physical, Kuzari famously lend themselves also to different sorts of spiritual growth, different sorts of spiritual aspirations, positive or negative. And what's true in terms of place is also true in terms of time. That there are also different climates over the course of the year. In Yadus, we think of time as a spiral, hopefully an upward spiral, that time is one-dimensional and you move forward, but it's not entirely linear because at the same time you move from year to year to year, we also cycle around, and hopefully we come back a year later at a higher spot, but still at that same coordinate. There's something special about Nisan, there's something special about Tammuz, and each time of the calendar lends itself, a certain spiritual climate, lends itself more easily to different sorts of spiritual growth and aspiration. And Chaim Friedlander, in his Asif Sei Chaim, he addresses this strange-sounding Gemara, and he says that the truth is that the Gemara is capturing something critically important. The Gemara is saying that to feel the loss of Yerushalayim, that's really something difficult, except during this period of the year. I come here, and my phone works well. I go back to Beit Meir, so that's not always the case. Beit Meir, Baruch Hashem, is a little bit more rugged and rustic. And some of you who have spent some time together with us at Beit Meir know, you know, sometimes you'll see boys in the program that are sort of find just the right spot or leaning over just the right angle so you can get klita for a couple of moments. So if you're in a, if you're making a phone call in Beit Meir and the conversation gets a little bit touchy and all of a sudden there's a click, so you're not sure how to interpret that. Does that mean that I offended the other person and he dropped the call? Or just did he hang up on me, or just, you know, we lost our connection? When your reception is crystal clear, you know when the call has ended. If I'm in a situation where in a place where reception is poor, and I tune to my favorite radio station, and it's all, and I don't hear anything being broadcast, well, maybe it's just a lack of reception. If I'm in an area where the reception is crystal clear, all the other stations are coming in, I turn to one and I hear not static but nothing, but I know that they've stopped broadcasting. So Rav Chaim Friedlander suggests that that's what this Gemara is capturing. That for a Jew to feel the loss of Mikdash is not a simple thing. To feel that, to really understand, not just to go through the motions, but to feel that we're missing something in our relation with the Kaddish Baruch Hu is, in the month of Kislev, requires an unusual amount of spiritual accomplishment to really feel that there's something missing. But it's during these weeks and these days where our reception is crystal clear. And ironically, there's a certain unique closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he suggests, during the period leading up to Tisha B'Av, the sort of closeness and the sort of clarity which allows us to notice what we're missing. We have that, there's no static. And we can tell that the station isn't broadcasting. We can tell that the call was dropped intentionally. We know that we're able to tune into Ribbono Shel Olam during this time that leads up to Tisha B'Av. That's the spiritual climate this time of the year, a closeness, an opportunity, a potential for closeness that allows us to notice more easily. One need not be Eliezer Zeira to notice that something's not right. To notice that Ribbono Shel Olam ought to be broadcasting us. We ought to have a closeness, an easy intimacy with the Kaddish Baruch Hu that's missing. And it's easier for every Jew to feel that and to plug into that avail. So that really is the avoda of this corner of the year. Is to take that opportunity. If the potential is here in greater degree than any other time of the year, so our avoda is to use that, to leverage the opportunity and to begin to think seriously. So what is it that we're missing? What does it mean to miss a Beis HaMikdash? What is the gap in our neshama? What is the gap in our hearts? What's the gap in our experience? So what I'd like to do is to spend the next couple of minutes together looking to trying to develop that to things that we miss. And I want to start with a clue. I want to start with an intellectual gap. Look, take a look at a sefer and see that there's a piece of a puzzle that's missing. And we'll go from that to take a look at a tapestry that Rav Schefter puts together in the 12th chapter of Eretz HaTzvi, weaving together threads from different shiurim of the Soloveitchik at different points in time. And hopefully that will help us make sense of this missing puzzle piece and give us perhaps a greater, deeper appreciation of what it is that we miss during this time and what it is that we, the gap that we look forward to Ribbono Shel Olam filling very soon. I want to begin by taking a look at the way the Rambam begins to talk about the mitzvah of Beis HaMikdash. When the Rambam begins to talk about Kabanos, he is, as always, a master organizer. And one of the Rambam's primary objectives in writing his Mishnah Torah, which is meant to be a review of all the conclusions of Torah Sheba'al Peh. The Rambam tried to take Gemara as conversational, Talmud as conversational. It's officially topical, but you sort of go from one topic to the next. One of the Rambam's primary goals in writing the Mishnah Torah was to take everything and put it back into strict logical order. So two of his 14 Svarim are dedicated to Karbanos, but he begins with all the preliminaries. And the first of all is the mitzvah to build a Beis HaMikdash. And that's what you have here in the middle of the first page. Hilchos Beis HaBechira. You'll pardon my Mivtah, my Havara Ashkenazis. Rambam opens up Sefer Avodah, mitzvah saseh, livnos bayis la'Hashem. The opening mitzvah, before he gets to the details of what happens in the Beis HaMikdash, is the mitzvah to build a Beis HaMikdash. Jewish people have mitzvah to build a Beis HaMikdash. Muchan lios makrivim bar karbanos, a place to bring karbanos, a place that's meant to be the destination of the Jewish people three times a year, aliyah l'regel. And then he in the halachas Beis Gimel and Dal that don't appear in the sheet, He begins to sketch a little bit of the history that we the Jewish people fulfilled this mitzvah in different formats over the course of centuries. We had the Mishkan in Midbar, we had Shiloh, and then we have the Bayis Rishon and the Bayis Sheni. We look forward to the Bayis Shlishi. And then he says, you know, those looked very different, and whatever the mitzvah can be implemented in different ways. What are the critical elements in any mikdash? The Eilei HaDvarim in Halacha Hei, Shein Iker B'Binyan HaBayis, what are the critical elements that need to be in place? In Halacha Hei, he talks about the architecture. That you need to have a building with several rooms, an outer room and an inner room, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and then that building of the Beis HaMikdash needs to be surrounded by an open air courtyard, called either the Chatzer or the Azara, and most of the action of Karbanos took place in the open air courtyard that surrounded the building of Beis HaMikdash. And then he moves on in Halacha Vav to say that it needs to be not only an architectural space, a bayis in the most basic sense, but it needs to be a furnished home. The Osim Mikdash Shiva Kelim. And it says that most Batei Mikdash had many, many, many hundreds of Kelim. But there are seven that are absolutely critical. And that number seven is good because it means that we're not missing anything on this list. And you count on your fingers. This is not when you have the outer Mizbeach in that courtyard where the Karbanos would take place. The number two is the ramp that led up to that tall Mizbeach, as well as the Kior Vekano, the place, two parts that together would be used for the Kohanim to wash their hands. That's four Kelim in the outer space, in the courtyard, in the Chatzer. And then he goes on to say, in the continuation of this halacha, he goes on to say that there were as well three kelim inside. There was a menorah, and there was a shulchan for lechem panim, and there was an inner golden, small golden mizbeach that he used for ketores. Seven kelim altogether. You notice anything missing? Yeah. Just in mitzvachaf. He also gives you the list. He says it's a mitzvah of making Beis HaMikdash, and it means both the construction of the walls and the spaces as well as the furniture. And there too, the Aron is remarkably absent. And very strange. Very, very strange. Well, what happened to the Aron? Do you not need an Aron? It's the missing Ark. The Ark is missing in the Sefer. So how do you make it? What's the Rambam driving at? In fact, the Ramban in his commentary in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, he gives he actually counts making an Aron as a separate mitzvah in its own right. You know, the Rambam didn't even include it as part of the furniture of Beis HaMikdash. So what are we going to make? What's the significance of this, and what are we going to make of the missing Aron? So I want to put this aside for a moment. The fact that in the opening chapter, the Rambam left Aron out. I want to move, as I said before, to take a look at a tapestry of a couple of threads that Salvation put together at different times. And the first one is where the Aron appears too much. If you move fast forward to the fourth parak of Halachas Beis HaBechirim, after the first three chapters in which the Rambam surveys how to build, gets into all the details of how to build the spaces and how to make the Mizbeach and the Menorah and so on and so forth. And once again, it's absolutely silent about how to make an Aron. In the fourth chapter, he shifts from the details of the mitzvah of construction of Beis HaMikdash to sort of the concept of Beis HaMikdash. And he opens the next couple in Perek Daleh and continues the next couple of prokhim to talk about the different levels of what Beis HaMikdash accomplished. The different levels of Kedusha. Starting with the most intense, in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, where the only Kohen Gadol would enter, and only once a year in Yom Kippur, and through working one's way out to the way in which that Kedusha spread with Mispashetes to lesser and lesser degrees throughout different areas of the Beis HaMikdash and throughout Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael as a whole. And he begins with the focusing on the center. He very dramatically opens. There was a stone in the center of the Beis HaMikdash. Evan Haisa Bekosh HaKadoshim Ma'aravo. There was a stone that we know Tanam tell us in the days of the second Beis HaMikdash. There was an empty stone. Kohen Gadol would walk in to the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and it was an empty stone. And the Avod of Yom Kippur would take place around that empty stone. But originally, in the Bayis Rishon, that's where the Aron was. That's where the Aron was, with the Luchos, with the Kruvim. So that, some Tanam tried to figure out. So where did the Aron go? We know we have the tradition in the first base of Mikdash there was an Aron on that stone, but throughout the day, second base of Mikdash, Kohan Gadol would go in every year on Yom Kippur, and it was just an empty stone. So where is the missing Aron? So Rambam goes on to discussion, Tanoim have Masechus Yuma. Here you have further down the page. The Mishnah says, Mishanital Aron. Mishnah Yuma records, that Aron used to be that once the Aron was taken away, Evan Hayisasham. There was a stone that was there, Kandala would perform Avod on that stone. Where did the Aron go? The Gemara is very sensitive to the language. Where did the Aron go? Where was it taken? The Gemara presents a machlokas hatanoim. Where did the Aron disappear? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, so the Gemara quotes a series of Tanaim who debated how to read the Psukim. Two options. One option is Nebuchadnezzar came, sacked the first Beis HaMikdash, and took everything. He took the golden menorah, took the golden shulchan, and he found an Aron in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And that too is somewhere in some museum, perhaps Ad HaYom HaZeh. He went to a museum in Iraq. He went to a museum in Babel. And that's where it is, and we never got it back. That's option number one. Option number two the Gemara presents is that Nebuchadnezzar never saw the Aron. That Shlomo HaMelech, when he built the Beis HaMikdash, understood the Beis HaMikdash might not last forever, and so he built a security system in the basement. He built a vault, and that vault was there to be used with a couple hundred years. The last real king, before his children, grandchildren were all puppet kings at the very end of Bayis Rishon, Yoshio realizes that things aren't going to last forever. He can read the signs, he can tell. Sooner or later, the basement is going to go down, and he decides now is the time to use the vault. They put the Aron in the basement. Nebuchadnezzar comes, and the Aron is nowhere to be found. Okay. So they have a machlokas, a maseches yuma, machlokas hatanan. How do you read the psukim in Nevi'im? What happened to the Aron? A fascinating historical machlokas. But then you take a look back at the top source on the second page. The Rambam addresses this question. The Rambam says there was a stone. In the second line, "Ve'esha bana Shlomo Sabayis," when Shlomo built Beis Hamikdash, "Ve'yadash asofer lecharev," he understood that there was a likelihood that this Beis Hamikdash would not be the last one. "Bana makom lignozbo ha'aron lamata," he builds, he includes a cellar, and they put the aron there, and there the aron remains to this day. Beautiful, dramatic, but seems entirely out of place in a work of halacha. No one, how do you paskin a historical machlokas? Machlokas had time to read the psukim. So either the Aron is in the basement in Yerushalayim, or the Aron is somewhere in sold in the black market in Iraq. Wherever it is, it is. But how do you paskin a historical machlokas? And even were one going to paskin a historical machlokas, it doesn't seem to fit. It's the wrong location. Rambam is discussing halacha. Mishnah Torah is not a historical work. So why are they taking a stand? But that question is raised actually in remarkably similar language by both Rabbi Yaakov Emden in his parish on Hilchos Beis HaBechira and by the Rav, and they give remarkably similar answers. But before I come to their answer, let's look at some more questions. I want to take a look at near the bottom of the page, a famous Agada Maseches Nida. Maseches Nida, Daflam, the Gemara talks about perhaps one of the most famous Agadas in all of Shas. Gemara talks about the Uber B'meimo, a baby in utero. Gemara describes the baby has a utopian existence, learning with the Malach, learning all of Torah, and on the way out, a slap from the Malach, and everything is forgotten. So it's a gemara that many of us have come to love as children, but you take a look at it again as an adult. There's a mashal about that I have to share. So as a sidebar for a moment, they say in the name of Yaakov Kamenetsky that talking about religious maturation. So they said, you imagine nowadays. I don't know what the story is in Beit Shemesh, but where I live. Upsharons are all the craze. It's no longer unique to Hasidim. Everyone's doing upsharons from Englewood to Lakewood. Everyone does upsharons. We still we don't make upsharons, but our kids get a haircut when they need a haircut. But when a kid turns three, a boy turns three, he's ready to put on tzitzis. You make a tzitzis party. You celebrate that important stage of chinuch and tzitzis. So Rebbe Karmatsky said, you imagine for a moment the tzitzis party. And the boy is 3 years old, and he's trained, and he's ready to wear tzitzis, and he gets up on a chair, cute little boy, and you take out the size 3 tzitzis with the puff paint, the mitzvah train, or whatever, however it's decorated, and he puts and makes the bracha, puts the tzitzis up, and claps, and you have a party, everyone's so excited. And we're right to be excited, and we're right to celebrate. But imagine if the boy is no longer 3 years old, and he's now 23, or 53, or 83, still wearing that size 3 tzitzis, which by now is choking him around the neck, but there's clearly nothing left to celebrate. Because it's obvious to us that the physical aspects of our avos Hashem need to grow with us as we grow. It's less obvious, but far more essential, that the intellectual and emotional and spiritual aspects of avos Hashem need to grow and mature with us, to fall under the being introduced to Kriya Shema at the age of 3, and meeting Avraham Avinu and Moshe Rabbeinu at the age of 5, and maybe meeting Shmona Esrei at the age of 8. So, and at that time, we got an age-appropriate 3-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 8-year-olds understanding of those concepts. It's easy to just sort of go with the flow and never revisit. And if we don't choose to actively revisit, one can go through life with a 6-year-old's understanding of the Nes of Purim. Now, clearly, Bereishis was meant for 5-year-olds, and clearly, Bereishis was not only meant for 5-year-olds. And it clearly is a lot more to Avraham Avinu than a 5 or 6 or 7-year-old could possibly understand. And the way to address that is to make the choice to proactively revisit and to learn to think and to ask the questions that we ask as adults and to seek the depth in those ideas, the depth of understanding, the depth of feeling that we're capable of as adults. So we look at this Haggadah, and if we met this Haggadah as children, so we had a child's appreciation. But you look at it again as an adult, you wonder, what does this mean? What does it mean that you learn Torah in utero? It seems pointless, and it seems cruel. There's nothing gained. You learned, and you walk out with nothing. And it seems the Malach has nothing better to do this time than to teach Tom. Can you imagine the frustration, right, of this Mechanach who knows in advance, he's giving Shurim, and his Talmidim will never remember anything that he taught. Right? That's just terrible. But more to the point, is what's the goal? On the Olkain aside, what's the purpose of this? And it seems worse than pointless. This is a cruel tease to teach, and then just as you're about to enter the world, be able to do some of what you've learned, it gets yanked away. Well, what's the Gemara driving at? What's it supposed to mean? One more question. So far we have 3 questions. On the one hand, the Aron is missing. Rambam describes in Perek Aleph what it means to build a Beis HaMikdash, and the Aron is nowhere to be found. Nowhere to be found in the summary definition in Perek Aleph, in Prakim Beis, and Gilman gives the details of how to build each part, not a word about how to make a Beis HaMikdash. On the other hand, question number 2, is he says too much about the Aron in Perek Dalet. Describing the Kodesh HaKadoshim, he goes out of his way to tell us that he paskins, that the Aron historically was buried under Har Moriah. Problem number 3 is what's with this Talmud Torah to the infant? And what are we, as adults, to make of that Agada? Let's tie it all together by looking at point number 4. Here on the second page, the Gemara Megillah Daf Chavav and Beis. Rabbi Sablevsky and I have the privilege this summer of learning, giving Shurim Maseches Megillah to the boys in Ensis Rakolo. So, second parak, third parak, here's the Gemara at the beginning of the fourth parak. The Gemara tells us a well known halacha, the halacha of Geniza, or as we chutznikim for some reason call Seamus. So, Gemara says that not everything has to. What goes in Seamus? What's supposed to be put in Geniza? So the Gemara says that tzitzis do not have to go into Seamus. Gemara says items used for mitzvahs are categorized into 2 classes. Tana Rabbanan, Megillah Chavavim Beis. Tashmishay mitzvah nizrakin, tashmishay kedusha nignazin. Items that are used for a mitzvah can be politely thrown in the garbage. I'm not going to put them in with the chicken bones. They put them in an office trash can, or you wrap them in a bag and then put them in the garbage, but they can be put in the Nizrakin. They can be thrown in the trash. But Kashmisha, Kedusha, items that serve as Kedusha, Nignaz, and they have to go into Genizim. So the Brisa wants to know, how do you define these two categories? Elin Tashmisha Mitzvah. Tashmisha Mitzvah are Sukkah, Lulav, Shofar, Tzitzis. How about Tashmisha Kedusha? What needs Geniza? So Gemara says the items that are wrappings for the Sefer Torah Tefillin and Mezuzah, or the Ritzuos of Tefillin, and so on. All mitzvahs have kedusha, don't they? Isn't it? Asher kedushan sotzev yitzvanu leishev basukah. Asher kedushan sotzev yitzvanu latiyos lulav. Before you engage in these mitzvahs, talk about the kedusha that these mitzvahs endow us with. So they're all tashmishe mitzvah, and they're all tashmishe kedusha, aren't they? So what's this categorization? What needs geniza and what doesn't need geniza? So the difference is that yeah, they're all used for mitzvahs. But tashmishe kedusha are items which have a permanent kedusha, which even after the mitzvah is done, the kedusha endures in this object, and the object therefore needs to be put into geniza. What's unique about that category, they're all connected to ksav shel Torah. They're all connected to tefillin, mezuzah, sefer Torah. It's not just there's a mitzvah to read the Torah, it's the mitzvah to put a mezuzah, but it's connected to words of Torah. An item that either has words of Torah written on it, or is ritzuos connected to the words of Torah. So the words of Torah give the item, endow it with a durable, permanent kedusha that will survive even after the mitzvah is over. Sukkah and lulav may have kedusha over the course of sukkahs, but when sukkahs comes and goes and the mitzvah is no longer, then the item doesn't retain any permanent kedusha. But tefillin mezuzahs are different because they're connected to ksav shel Torah, and that may explain some of the other pieces as well. Let's work our way backwards. Gemara says that this agada that the baby may emo. So Rabbi Handel would certainly have heard him speak in the past about, you know, students may forget certain facts, but the education is what endures when the information learned has been forgotten. The information, the data may come and go, but the person can be changed by the experience of having learned it. And it's certainly true in Torah. And what the Rav suggests is what this Agada is capturing is that a child isn't born with Torah knowledge, but a Jewish neshama comes into this world not as a tabula rasa, not as a blank slate, but a Jewish neshama does come to this world preloaded with a connectedness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, preloaded, endowed with the kedusha, a kedusha which that Rambam describes in the end of the second paragraph of Hilchos Gerushin as the fact that deep even Rambam gives a specific halachic application of this that every Jew deep down in the core of his personality, every Jew wants to do that which HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants him. Every Jew wants to lead his life in an ideal fashion. But, you know, we're all, if one were to be a psychological archaeologist, you would say that every person has layers and layers and layers of accretion on top of that core. The core within wants connection with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. The core within is a core of Kedusha. That's the Pintaliyid that we sometimes speak of. But, you know, you go through life, and there are layers and layers of mud and sludge and distraction and rat races that sort of cause us to forget what's really important. It sometimes cause us to lose track of where our moral compass deep down, which way it really points. But that core is formed before a person even comes into this world. That's what that Gemara Maseches Nida is describing. And what's fascinating is the way the Gemara captures that reality of being connected to Kedusha in a durable way. Once again, like the Gemara Megillah, it's through Torah. The Gemara doesn't say that we do mitzvahs. The Gemara doesn't just say a conversation, a meeting with the Malach. The Gemara describes it as Limud HaTorah. Because Torah, apparently, is a source of durable Kedusha. As Rabbi Shechter puts in the name of the Rav, Kedusha ultimately comes from a connection to Kadosh Baruch Hu, and the avenue, the conduit through that which that Kedusha connects to Olam Hazeh, is predominantly through Torah. And connectedness to Torah will create a permanent kedusha. That's why the human parallel to the notion of tashmisha kedusha nignazin, of course, is the fact that a Jewish body requires kavura. Even after the Jewish body is a person has passed away, and the body is no longer, the hands and feet are no longer performing mitzvahs, and the eyes and the mouth are no longer performing mitzvahs. But a body that was connected to Torah, whether through active Talmud Torah as a child or an adult, or even if it's just the Torah learned in utero, but that creates a permanent connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that endows a physical body with permanent Kedusha, a Kedusha that we respect even after that body is no longer functioning. And now, working our way back, that Rav suggested that also explains the Rambam's strange psak. And let's move back to point number two. Rambam was bothered. The Tanan debated in Masechet Yuma what happened to the Ark. Did Shlomo prepare a subterranean cellar that Yoshiel used, or no? It was left there. There were no security precautions taken then. So when Nebuchadnezzar came and invaded, he walked off with the Ark. So what type of psak, and why is it halachic? So both Yaakov and the Rav suggest, in remarkably similar terminology, that the Rambam understood that that is a halachic machlokas. It's not merely a question of historical interest, but how to understand, interpret the psukim, Yishayahu and Malachim and Divrei Yamim. That's where the machlokas begins. But the machlokas really is a halachic machlokas. What they're arguing about is not just where is the Aron, but the opinion that Rambam adopts, that the Aron b'mekomo nignas, that it was and remains underneath the subterranean chamber underneath Harabayas, understand not just that it happened to be that it is there, but that were it not to be there, there would be no Kedushin Beis HaMikdash. There could not have been a second Beis HaMikdash. We hold, as a halachic opinion, there could not have been a second Beis HaMikdash were the Aron to have been taken away, because the source of Kedusha of Makam Mikdash ultimately resides in the Aron. It's the fact that there's Torah there, that Luchos, and the Sefer Torah, that's what endows the Harabayas with the Kedusha. And it's of halachic necessity that the Aron be there. And that perhaps was part of what was driving Shlomo and Yoshio was not only the incredible, to call it sentimental seems so shallow, but the sentimental value of inestimable magnitude of keeping the Aron, of keeping the Luchas, and keeping the Kruvim. It wasn't only that, and for that alone it certainly would have been worthwhile, but it was actually understanding that if the Aron disappears, there's no more Beis HaMikdash. There's no more possibility of having a Makom HaKudosh on Har HaBayis and Har HaMoriah. As a matter of fact, the Rav goes on to suggest that perhaps the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael as a whole was rooted, and certainly the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael during the period of from Yehoshua until the Churban Bayis Rishon suggests that perhaps that Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael was rooted in Torah, because the Psukim describe that the Aron would always travel to at the vanguard of the conquering Jewish army. As they worked their way through Eretz Yisrael during Kibush Haaretz, the Aron was a significant player. Perhaps not only because they reminded the Klal Yisrael of the Ribbono Shel Olam was ultimately the one who was giving them the power to succeed militarily. And not only because they would be bringing Shechina into the base, would transform the base, and would transform the military expedition, but it was because that was the Mekadesh of Eretz Yisrael. It was the Kibush headed, led by an Aron, led by Luchos, that endowed Eretz Yisrael piece by piece with the Kedusha that Kibush V'chiluk gave it. So that's the case. If that's the case, then we can come back to the question of how to make a mikdash, and not a word about the Aron. Now there is, the truth is, there is a word about the Aron. It just isn't in Hilchos Beis Sedechiyah Paragal. It's back on the first page right below. It's the very, very end of Hilchos Sefer Torah. The second to last halacha. I'm not talking about, he has a 10 Shev Rambam, his approach was never to have a unit that was less than 3 krakim long, probably based on the Gemara's rule, Maseches Bava Basra, that the Anshei Knesset HaGedola didn't want to have Sifrei Tanakh that would be too short. That's why the Treyasar were not together, historically in any way. They lived in different parts of Eretz Yisrael and Bavel. They lived over the course of a couple of centuries. But the Gemara says they were put together because each one only had a modest amount of nevuah that was being recorded in the Doros, and there was a concern that especially some of them are particularly short, Ovadia and Malachi and Chagai. There was a Yonah, there was a concern if they're so small, I did Zutri Mirkasi, and something will get lost. So you put them, you combine them into one large sefer that has half, they'll be more durable. The Rambam seems to have picked up on that line, the Gemara. So his rule seems to be he never has a section of Mishnah Torah less than three prakim long. If there is something, a topic with one or two prakim, so he'll combine with something else. So Hilchas Tefillin, Mezuzah is only two prakim, so he makes into a 10-parak set, four prakim of Tefillin, two prakim Mezuzah, and the last four prakim, Zayin to Yud, are Hilchas Sefer Torah. The very, very end of Hilchas Sefer Torah, he writes the following. After spending most of the time in the mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah, and how you write a Sefer, all the details of the parchment and the ink, and the layout and the format, and how the ksiva is done, he writes and takes a step back into the end to talk about, once you have a Sefer Torah, what do you do with it? And how do you treat it? So let's read this Rambam together. Mitzvah liyacheid l'sefer Torah makom. Here at the bottom of page one. The mitzvah to have a dedicated place for a Sefer Torah, to make sure that a Sefer Torah has a dedicated spot. In a shul, obviously, you're going to have Aron Kodesh, because that's what Surah's Beis HaKnesses demands. But even when it has a private Sefer Torah at home, it's not in a shul, it's still, it can't just be, you can't just put it wherever. It needs, you have to have an Aron Kodesh at home. Even if you're not, if it's not a functional shul, a Jew wrote a Sefer Torah to keep at home, it has to have a Malkum Yuchad. That's part of Kavod Sefer Torah. Lahadriyo Semidai, to give Sefer Torah excessive kavod. And then he goes on afterwards to talk about various activities that we avoid in the presence of Sefer Torah. Not to spin in front of Sefer Torah, not to be dressed inappropriately in front of Sefer Torah, and so on and so forth. The way if one needs to transport a Sefer Torah, to transport Sefer Torah with unusual respect. But the basis, what's the basis for this? How do we know that you have to give Sefer Torah, I did put it, Yosher Midai, excessive kavod? So he writes, Devarim is in the second line, Devarim Shebeluchos Habris, Hen Hen Shebechol Sefer V'Sefer. That which applies to the Luchos should certainly, equally, or certainly apply to every single Sefer Torah. So what that line just mean? What just happened there? And he sort of goes on to get into all the details. In conversation, Rav Shechter once pointed out to me that here's where the Rambam discusses making an arm. It's here. Because what the Rambam just said, what do we mean? That which applied to Luchos applies to every Sefer Torah. What do we mean? That which applied to Luchos. Meaning that the Luchos had a Makam Yuchad. And the Luchos, we were Mechabed, Mahadriyo, Simidai. What was that unique location? That unique location was what the Sukkim described in Parshas Truma as the Aron with the Kruvim. So it's fascinating. I would have thought that the mitzvah of making an Aron is part of the mitzvah of making a Beis HaMikdash. Just like part of the mitzvah of making a Beis HaMikdash for the Rambam includes making a Shulchan and making a Menorah, so on and so forth. Part of the mitzvah is to make an Aron. The Rambam says, no. That apparently was a one-time tzivui to Moshe Rabbeinu. That was Haru HaShah. In the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, he had a chiyuv to make an Aron with Kruvim. That's not a permanent thing. And Achron, to break. Can't be part of that. That's sort of miraculous promise. Can't be part of the halachic system. So what would it didn't be were the Aron to break? Well, the Rambam never addressed how to make the specifications for how to make an Aron, how to make Kruvim the way he does the other Kalim. So it seems like in the Chanan. That in terms of Hilchos Mikdash, that is not critical. And were the Aron, hypothetically, were we to retrieve the Aron but the Kruvim were broken, we wouldn't necessarily make new Kruvim. That was Moshe's one-time mitzvah. Moshe had a one-time mitzvah to split the Yam. He had a one-time mitzvah to restrict the Jews from entering Har Sinai during the time of Kabbalah Sadara. He had Harua Shah to make the Aron according to those specifications, the gold and the wood and the gold and the Kruvim. Just as were I to approach, if I could figure out historically where the Yamsuf, where the Jews crossed the Yamsuf, I were to retrieve Mata Moshe and go, I have no mitzvah of Netei Sad HaYamu V'Kayim. And even were I to go to the Yom Suf and wave Moshe's Mata anywhere to split, that certainly would be incredibly impressive, but it wouldn't be a mitzvah. Right? Because that's not a mitzvah doros. That was a one-time Haru HaShah. It seems like Ram understood that the details of Aron were Haru HaShah. What is halachically the doros is that it's not really halacha in Mikdash. It's halacha in Kavod Sefer Torah. And halo davar hu.
He says, well, if the Luchos require a special Aron Kodesh, so too does every Sefer Torah. Now, again, I'm not familiar with the architectural details of the shul. I don't think it's encased in gold and afeshitim and another layer of gold. It doesn't need to be. But the idea of the Aron is Makim Yuchad L'Chabdo U'L'Hadro. Now, if you asked me, I would have said, oh, yeah, that was a Luchos. Author's copy. Unbelievable Kedusha. But this, you know, a Sefer Torah written by a human being more than 3,000 years later, is it as clear that it requires as much Kedusha? And it requires as much Kavod? Yet, Rambam seems to say, absolutely, at least as much Kavod for a Sefer Torah, which encompasses all the words of Torah, than Luchos, which only have a fraction of the Torah. So from a sentimental perspective, clearly it's not the same. But in terms of the Kedusha, like I said, if the source of Kedusha, the conduit, primary conduit for Kedusha in our lives in Olam HaZeh is Torah. So if the Luchos did it, then the Sefer Torah certainly is going to do it. Which is a tremendous mechayev for us. Not to say, you know, back in those days, that was real. What are we going to do? No. Our Torah matters to Ribono Shel Olam incredibly. And now with that, we also come back to solve the problem of the missing Aron. Because the Rambam is engaged in trying to define a mitzvah. And Rambam has rules for how Rambam is an unusually methodical man, and before he begins his enumeration of the 613 mitzvahs, his Sefer Mitzvahs has three parts. Part 2 is the 248 mitzvahs asay. Part 3 is the 365 mitzvahs lo asay. But part 1, he says, before we can get started with any sort of enumeration, we need to lay out what are the criteria. You can't just haphazardly, there are many, many more than 613 halachos. So how are we to know what's a mitzvah? So he begins by laying out 14 sharashim, 14 criteria by which we're going to define what qualifies a mitzvah, what doesn't. One of those rules is it has to appear in Chumash. Another rule has to be a Doraisa. Another rule is it needs to be Ladoros, right? Unlike, like splitting the sea or not entering Har Sinai. Another one, later in his list, is that we don't count preliminaries. If I need to tie tzitzis in order to wear tzitzis, need to make a sukkah in order to sit in a sukkah, those are important, but the mitzvah is sitting in the sukkah. Making the sukkah is a hechsher mitzvah that doesn't get counted in the main ha-mitzvahs. So I think Rama understood that having an aron, having luchos, in the details of making an aron apparently were harasha. The notion that you have to have the luchos in the base of mitzvah some way, that's not the mitzvah. The mitzvah itself is to make a Ribono Shel Olam and lighting. And furniture will include a kitchen, in human terms. Furniture may include scenting, good ventilation. So, the furniture is going to include the table, the shulchan, furniture will include the lighting, the menorah, and the mizbech ktoros, the mizbech hanachoshes. Aron isn't part of the furnishing of the home. What the aron is, it's the power source of the home. The aron is what powered everything. But that's a preliminary. In order to make a mikdash, making a mikdash will be all the furniture that gets used. But the aron is absolutely critical, and that's why it appears in Perek Dalet. When Perek Dalet begins talking about the kedusha of mikdash, he begins from the source of it all, which is the Kodesh HaKadosh, which once housed the aron above, and nowadays houses the aron down below. So the aron is absolutely the source of the kedusha of mikdash. It's the mekadesh of mikdash, much as the Torah is the mekadesh of Eretz Yisrael. And Torah is the Mekadosh of every Jewish person. And Torah is the Mekadosh of Ritzuas HaTfilin. Because Torah is the source of Kedusha, as Torah is the way, the primary avenue, living Torah and learning Torah, is the primary avenue through which we bring Kedusha and nobility into our lives in Olam HaZeh. And the Torah, the Aron being there, is when need conception to come before anything else could be in place. But the mitzvah itself is something that comes later. I just close where I begin. Number one, that I hope these Tivrei Torah today will be Ilui Neshama for people, those who knew Poppy and Granny. We always think of them as very much as a pair. The people who certainly made the conscious decision during their lives to bring Torah into their lives and to fill their lives thereby with Kedusha and with nobility and with intense concern for others. And it's our hope that through doing the avoda, what Eliezer Zeira could do all year long, the avoda that we at least have the chance as simple Jews to do it during this period of time, to hopefully to take the opportunity
to think carefully what Mikdash meant, and that Mikdash was much more than just. Had it been just Makam Lahakir Bar Karbanos, that alone, Dayenu. But as the Rambam tells us, at the very beginning of Hanukkah's Beis Bechira, it's a place for Karbanos, and it's also a place for Aliyah Regel. It's a place where, in the larger sense, connected to the Kadosh Baruch Hu. It was a center of Torah, it was a center of Adi Yom HaZeh Tefillah. It's a center for all the different avenues through which we connect to Kadosh Baruch Hu. Just as the Torah that we learn, the way which HaKadosh Baruch Hu connects to us, we hope that this lacuna, this gap of Gom Shalom, will close it very soon. Thank you so much.
Okay, our next year will begin in about 6 minutes at 10:30. I just want to thank again the Borvik family and the extended Borvik family for sponsoring this morning's shir by Rav Tanfun Cohen in memory of Mr. Samuel Z. Cohen, Nissan El Zalman Ben Yaakov HaKohen on his 20th Yortzeit, Mr. Shama Valiya. And we'll start again in about 5 minutes. Coffee in the back, Danish. Please enjoy some more and please stay for the next year. Mark, did you shut this off?